ESPN College Football Podcast, hosted by David Pollack and Reese Davis.
USC does what was going to happen eventually. They do it immediately, and some say it was overdue. So what now after Clay Helton? Why this week could reshape the playoff picture again, plus Alabama, Florida, Auburn, Penn State, and all of the huge games right now on the ESPN College Football Podcast, Reese Davis and David Pollack on Tuesday, September 14th. Pollack and I are here every Tuesday. So, Pollack, let's start with USC moving on from Clay Helton. You know, it's been a rocky road. It's been up and down for Helton. People have been sitting there waiting for him to be fired. And finally, it happened. There was some inconsistency. The performance Saturday night was abysmal. But before we go into who's going to follow him, and that's important, I want to say this. Clay Helton was the right man at the right time for that job in the moment. Here's why. USC had a run of coaches that cared more about getting inside the red velvet ropes at Bootsy Bellows than about getting a first down. Clay Helton wanted to get a first down and get off the field on third down, and USC needed that, and they had some success, but they deserved more. But this has not been since, you know, really with the exception of Pete Carroll, they've made a lot of questionable decisions. I mean, people think John McKay and Howard Jones and the legends, they also have Ted Tolner and they've got Paul Hackett. And then Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian were probably smart hires, but at the wrong time because of extracurricular activities. So were you at all? I wasn't surprised after the performance Saturday night that USC decided to make the move now. Were you?
No, I think we've heard this for years, right? Like they've been on the precipice of doing it several times. And I mean, Reese, it was pretty clear they didn't love him. It's pretty clear the fan base didn't love him. It was pretty clear that, first of all, he's a lovable guy. He's an awesome human being. Like he's a really cool guy. He's a coach. He had a lot of success his first two seasons as USC's coach. I mean, he was the most successful coach in that first 2 year span, like that kind of success. But there was something about it that didn't scream Hollywood. So it was kind of, it wasn't good from the start. So no, not surprised. Interested now to see where they turn the page, where they go. To me, Reese, there's one guy. Like I haven't heard your take, and I know you said you have a take on it. I haven't heard, but there's only one guy to me that's at the like first, second, and third on my list, and that's Matt Campbell. I mean, that's my guy. Like, and I'm sure you might have somebody else, but like USC's going to recruit itself. I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about anybody who goes to USC. They might not be USC in the past, and you might not get everybody, but you're going to get the best players in that region next to Oregon, probably now because Oregon's got it rolling. They're going to get great players at USC. You're shaking your head at me.
Now, why would you say that it recruits itself when they just had Clay Helton, who's won a Rose Bowl, and yet Bryce Young and DJ Uiagalelei and Tommy Brown and any number of other players are playing across the country? Didn't recruit itself with those guys. Those were all Southern California guys and big-time recruits.
I hear what you're saying. And those guys also, they're going to leave with Alabama and Clemson. Those teams, that's going to happen now. Those teams have had it rolling for a number of years. That's going to happen regardless. But you're still going to get great players at USC. You don't walk in that facility and look at all those Heisman trophies. Bro, you go to that facility, you're blown away. Like you are literally, they're playing a different game. Oregon and USC are playing a different game than everybody else out West. So, I mean, they're going to lose guys to Bama, of course. They're going to lose guys to Clemson and Georgia, yeah. But they're still going to get great players, especially compared to who else is in their conference. That's, to me, no doubt about it. Well, here's the thing. Matt Campbell's proven he's going to develop players. Matt Campbell's proven to have a great personality. That's kind of what? To me, it's kind of laid back. It's kind of smooth. I think he would get along with all types of people from all types of regions. He would make sure my team was tough. They would compete and fight and teach them the stuff, the intangible stuff that I think a lot of people are missing across the country. So to me, it's a slam dunk right away who I would hire.
That's not where I would go first. You have the first name correct, but not the surname. If I were Mike Bonin, you're going to hear a lot about Luke Fickell, and rightfully so, because he hired him at Cincinnati. If I were in that chair making the choice, the first thing I would do is go and make Matt Rhule convince me that he's happy in the NFL, and I would make him say no. Now, if he does, then we move on from there. And I'm not sure that I see Campbell fitting there. Because unless your name is Nick Saban or Urban Meyer, fit is important. And there are those are the only two guys out there right now that, in my judgment, transcend fit. Now, maybe Ryan Day does too, but he's very early in his career. Those two guys transcend fit. Everybody else needs to fit in the culture. John McKay had John Wayne on the sideline. Pete Carroll had Will Ferrell on the sideline and Snoop Dogg. I don't see Matt Campbell, and it doesn't have to be flashy, but I don't see him fitting there. It's also a question I have about Luke Fickell. The only, I guess, old school name that also potentially transcends fit would be Bob Stoops. I would have reservations about hiring Bob for this reason. Whoever you hire at USC has to be hungry, has to want it. And Stoops is one of the greatest coaches of this generation in college football. I'd need to be convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that he wanted it badly and couldn't live without it. And if that, then I would probably go Stoops, but not until after Matt Rhule had said no. Matt Rhule would be the guy for me that I would go to first. The other thing that would work that they'll never do, that would work now because the timing was wrong the
Lane
first
Kiffin.
Time. Yeah, if they ran it back with Kiffin, it would work. But I understand why you can't do it right now.
Well, I mean, of course, I didn't know we could go grab NFL coaches' names and just throw them in a bucket that have been there for 2 years. I mean, I don't think Matt Rhule's going to say yes.
Are you implying that hasn't happened? Have you noticed? Have you looked at the head coach at the University of Alabama lately?
Yeah, I don't think Matt Rhule's leaving. I mean,
well, maybe not. But I would go
Urban Meyer in there too. Then
I'd go make him say no, huh?
Urban Meyer at USC would be a good fit. Why not go Urban Meyer then? Like
same thing.
That's a better fit than Matt Rhule.
Rhule would be the guy for me.
And listen, we've gotten to know Matt Rhule. He is as cool as it gets. He's got a great personality. He can get along with everybody. But he can also demand of people and get in your hiney, which is why you like him and why we like him. But, you know, Fickell's interesting to me, too. I think he's done a great job resurrecting his career, but he doesn't scream California to me either.
I agree.
And he's developed it. But I trust, again, I would trust a Matt Campbell who's done it at a bigger level than Cincinnati, I think. And I just, man, I got so much respect for that guy and who he is and what he is. I think he would be uber successful. What the heck's he waiting for? I mean, this is not an indictment on Iowa State. It's a tough place to win, man. You're the great coaches in college football. A lot of times, Dabo Sweeney, Nick Saban, Ryan Day, Kirby Smart, these great coaches that we point to, they've got better talent than everybody. They're great. It's easy to be a, by the way, hey, go fly to Austin right now and ask Sark how easy it is to call offensive plays in Texas, bro. It's a whole nother level when you've got so much more daggum talent. So I'm impressed like crazy that guys that can do it. Bill Snyder was that guy for a long, long time. He almost went to LSU at one point in his career. If he'd have went there, he'd have won national titles. I think he'd be ranked higher on the coaching regime. He's one of those guys that I thought was unbelievable and so good at what he does. And I think Matt Campbell's in that boat. And I don't think it's going to happen at Iowa State. I don't think it's going to go next level there.
I agree with, and I think that's a great comparison to Bill Snyder. Certainly there's not the longevity at Iowa State under Matt Campbell that Bill Snyder had at Kansas State. Not yet. There's not the longevity of it, nor was, even though Iowa State was in dire straits, it was not the worst program in the country, which Kansas State was when Bill Snyder took over. The Bill Snyder coaching job is the greatest rebuild in the history of the sport. It's never been duplicated. And I think Campbell has established a similar foundation. But as it pertains to the potential, if in fact Campbell were to be on USC's list, long time ago, I know, but the second time USC brought John Robinson in, he went 0 for UCLA, 0 for 5, and his record was pretty good, though they went around 500 at the end and they ran him. Would it bother you at all that he hasn't been able to beat his rival, Campbell?
No, it wouldn't. I mean, it's part of it that you. Here's the thing. Let's do this honestly too. Then, is there that much difference between Iowa and Iowa State talent?
No.
No, absolutely not. So yeah, it's something I would have to consider 100%. I just think when you limit yourself from a standpoint of what you can be offensively and what you can be defensively, it makes it very difficult. Like they had a great conversation with you and Kirk about how it invented the three safety look. And it was out of necessity because we can't match up. We can't do X. We can't do Y. Like, it'd be nice to line up and go, oh, we can run quarters. I mean, we can do this. So I would love to see him have that opportunity. And by the way, I think Kirk Ferentz is another name you could throw in there that if he would have went somewhere else, would have built somewhere else into a national power and would have had a ton of success, who's also off of that Snyder tree. So I think all both those guys, I have that much respect for Kirk Ferentz too.
Yeah, Ferentz is a great coach. The longevity there. And I think one of the most impressive things that he's done that a lot of coaches at SC haven't been able to do is when it starts going badly is to turn it around. Now, in fairness, while they expect to win at Iowa, I don't think anyone would ever suggest that there's the same level of expectation of the level of winning at Iowa. So maybe that makes it easier, but I still believe that's one of the most difficult things for a coach to do is when his program veers in the wrong direction significantly. And I'm not talking about an occasional slightly down season. I'm talking about the program getting sideways. To get it back is a mark of a pretty astute leader and a great coach. Great coaching job that really changed the way we're going to evaluate the rest of the season happened Saturday in Columbus. You're wearing your Oregon gear in tribute to the Ducks. Travis, our producer. Yeah, he loves Ohio State. You kindly gave me props for saying week zero that I thought Oregon would go in and win. And I did. I wasn't trying to be a contrarian. But full disclosure, the reason I thought that was largely Thibodeau wrecking the game plan for a young quarterback. That was largely the reason. And I know when sportscasters say something like this, you know, people say, oh, it's not a one-man game. There are 11 people. That's true. But to win games at that level, you have to have game breakers or game wreckers. And because Thibodeau, to me, is the top game wrecker in college football, I thought that would carry the day along with their other exceptional defensive talent. What I didn't necessarily see coming, even with the struggles that Ohio State's had on defense, maybe saw it coming a little bit after the Minnesota game, but the evisceration of them with the running game, I didn't necessarily see it playing out that way. Did you?
Well, we talked about it with Joe Moorhead and how good he is and Anthony Brown. And I talked to you, you know, before game day on Saturday. And I just said, after going back and watching Anthony Brown, I think he's better than we think he is. And week one, Fresno, he makes a ridiculous touchdown pass. I think it was 33 yards to Johnny Jones. And he literally was right here and he just turns and flicks his wrist real quick. And it was on the money. And then he had that 30-yard speed option on fourth and two to win the game. I just think him and Moorhead together are going to be tough. They're going to be very formidable with Travis Dye and with CJ Verdell. And they do enough. And they have enough talent around them to be really, really good. Here's the thing. I didn't think Oregon's defense would be able to stop Ohio State that much. And to be honest, they didn't. They gave up 600 yards, for God's sakes. But what did they do? It was timely. It was fourth downs where they got off the field several times and bowed up. And I also, to be honest too, I didn't know that Ohio State's defense could suck this bad. I mean – bro, I literally – okay, so Sunday we did our
– they're ungood right now. I'm not saying untalented. I'm saying they're – you know I love to use that non-word. They're ungood at the moment in terms of execution.
So, Reese, we had our youth league football game on Sunday, played our game. Monday, we had film. Yesterday, we watched the tape every single week, and we teach. We worked on it yesterday. Corner wide receiver cracked our outside – cracked our safety corner. What do you do? Replace. That's a 12-year-old. Okay. A 12-year-old told me replace. Three touchdowns. Similar crap. Like, it's not, I'm playing man coverage. Yes, I'm playing man coverage. But if my guy clearly blocks down and takes that guy away and takes that gap away, I have to replace and become that defender. That is elementary crap. That is stuff. it gets me hot because it's defensive stuff that bothers me. Like, you know, the trenches for Ohio State, they're not as good as we thought they were. They're not as dominant as we thought they were. They've been able to overcome a lot of things up front because they've been so kick butt for so long. They're more down. They're a little more average. They're more human. So it was frustrating to watch. Ohio State has to do an autopsy and figure out what they're going to be, who they're going to be. Losing Proctor for the rest of the year, by the way, ain't good. Like, he's their best guy in the back end. If you saw touchdown after a couple of those touchdowns, I'm not even going to mention a name, but there was a backup safety in the game that looked really bad. Okay. Like, taking angles to the football and seeing things. So now you're going to throw that in there too. But listen, Ohio State's good enough to score on everybody they play and beat everybody they play. But that defense is not good enough to win a national championship. We can all say that right now.
Is Oregon good enough to win the national championship? I think if Flo and Thibodeau come back, I'm going to say yes. Now, I don't think Brown is, you know, ultra elite, but you can't scoff at the fact that you're dealing with a veteran guy who's got over 5,000 yards of offense and 50 some odd, you know, touchdowns or whatever it is. That's pretty strong. It's pretty strong stuff. You know, I mean, he even caught touchdown passes at Boston College, and I think he's kind of coming into his own, and he's kind of the type of quarterback that Moorhead's had success with, you know, in the past. So I think they are. They could.
I think they could.
Two guys have to be back. I believe that they need the difference makers. You know.
Yeah, they do, and I don't think they're elite defensively. But there is something to saying that I'm timely and making timely stops. And I don't think I have to be elite if my offense is really, really, really good. Here's the thing about their offense. Think about teams that will be in the playoff conversation. So right now you got Alabama and Georgia at 1-2. Who could give them problems? A scrambling quarterback. You have to have – you're not going to beat those teams with a stationary guy. It ain't going to work. You have a 0% chance. But new school football, RPOs, quarterback run game, tempo, all that stuff has a chance to be successful. So I give Oregon a really good chance to be in the mix. You got to tip the cap, and you got to give Cristobal and those guys credit to coming in there with a great mindset and taking care of business.
I know the headline game this week, as we flip the page and really start
turn
looking
the page
ahead here. Alabama, Florida is the marquee game, but here's the game. I want to talk about the game where we're going, which is also a huge game, Auburn and Penn State. And here's why. It ties into our discussion about Ohio State. Just as Clemson, because of its schedule and lack of marquee games, certainly not out of the big picture, but they sort of move to the back of the line because it's going to be hard to do something that is going to be really ultra impressive, right? Auburn and Penn State feels like a really significant game for the Big Ten as a whole because it can create more marquee games if Penn State wins. If Auburn beats Penn State after the way, with the notable exception of LSU at UCLA, the way the SEC in the early part of the season has run roughshod over other Power Five conference opponents. If Auburn, viewed to be a middle to upper middle team in the SEC, beats a top 10 ranked at the moment Big Ten team, that's gonna leave it in the hands of hoping Michigan runs the table to get to the end. Oh, for Michigan's sake too, for that matter. I'm not ready to put Michigan at that level. But, you know, since they've started 2-0, you know, whoever it is, or Iowa for that matter, although if Iowa's undefeated and beats whoever from the East, I think they'll be in good shape. But if you're talking one loss, that makes this a pretty significant game in terms of the ability to have marquee wins down the road. Agreed?
But my favorite part of being around you so long is I love when I catch certain phrases or certain things.
Like what?
like Penn State, who appears to be a top 10 team, meaning Reese doesn't believe they're a top 10 team at all in any way, shape, or form. By the way, I do not either. But I'm right there with you, because it's going to be interesting also too, Reese, comparing maybe Clemson and Ohio State. If there's one spot and you're fighting for it, like, who's going to be sitting there with it? Both have losses against really good teams, elite teams early in the season. What do they become? Who are their big wins? I think I like the stage you're setting right there for those two teams to go against each other. I haven't been impressed with Penn State. I know they scored against Ball State. Wisconsin lined up, pounded them in the mouth, ran the ball. I expect Tank Bigsby, by the way, to get a lot of touches. You know, Bo Nix has looked way better this year. He didn't have to do much, you know, yesterday. But Hunter is another guy running the football that they're going to – Auburn's making big plays. So they got two guys that can run the football. Bo Nix is athletic. I think this is an interesting matchup. It is. And I tell you what, Penn State's in a dangerous spot. The most competent quarterback in the world, Sean Clifford, that he made the comment. I'm still looking for the reason to buy into that statement as much as other people might be, but it's a huge game for the Big Ten, for the perception of the Big Ten, for the playoff push, and who's going to be the teams that are going to be the big games on the schedule. Like, we can see a bunch of big games in the SEC, and we can go down the list. Man, bam, 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 bam. You're going on the Big Ten schedule. We do this for game day. We're like, where are we going to be? Are we going to be in the Big Ten? Any? Are we going to be maybe? Maybe here, maybe here. Penn State loses this one.
This is a really tough environment, and some SEC fans might scoff at this. This is whiteout night game. Penn State is as electric, as difficult for a visitor as any place I've been in the sport. And I've covered this dating back to my local days. I've covered college football for 30 years. I've been a lot of great places. And there are some that would equal it, but nothing necessarily exceeds it. This is going to be tough. And I bring that up not for the old, oh, it's hard to go on the road, but because of the data on Bo Nix home versus Bo Nix road. At home, Auburn has won 12 of 14 games that he started. Completes 64% of his passes, 20 touchdowns, one interception. True road games, he completes 54% of his passes. His QBR is 30 points lower. It's a 40 on a scale of a 100. 9 touchdowns, 10 interceptions. His yards per attempt down 2. Now, he's a better quarterback. He did a lot of work this summer. I'm familiar with his individual quarterback coach. They've done a lot of things. He's really athletic. He's got skills. He understands the position. His dad was a terrific player. We're going to find out how much better. And because I think with Bo, a lot of it is mental. He's Auburn to the core. He wants so badly to lead them that I think that at times on the road in difficult situations, he's gotten a little wound up and hasn't played his best ball. And I don't think it's any secret that he wasn't the hugest fan of the offensive coordinator last year. So I think this is a
rightfully so. Rightfully so.
Well, and so I think this is a better fit for him, just as I think it's a better fit with Sean Clifford and Mike Yurcich. So I think there's a chance to see that both quarterbacks can sort of face the things that have plagued them in their careers up to this point and perhaps excel against them. It's an opportunity anyway to
do
so
on Saturday
more?
Night. A, Bo Nix, B, Sean Clifford, C, none of the above.
I don't want to say none of the above because I try to be a nice guy and I know that they're both good players. I would say that in their current circumstance, I need a little evidence before I say I trust them. Clifford against an elite opponent, which Auburn may or may not be, but we think they're a really good opponent, and Bo in a hostile environment against a good opponent. So I need more evidence. I wouldn't say that my trust factor is great in either one at the moment.
Yeah, mine isn't either. But I think whoever can play and win that matchup, obviously, goes a long way into determining. So I know we got more games to cover. So go ahead.
All right, what do you say about Bama, Florida? What's the biggest thing there? Is this as dangerous to Alabama as it seems?
You know more than me about the Bama situations, and usually with the injuries. Is Anderson good or no?
Don't know yet. Seems to be trending that way, but I don't know that anyone knows for sure yet, but it seems as if he'll be there. I said to someone today, Pollock, that, you know, whether it's, whether it's Drew Sanders, who's already in there for Chris Allen, or Braswell or Turner, or any of those young guys, you miss Chris Allen and you would certainly miss Will Anderson, but those guys can get it done. The difference is they are probably more likely to bust, you know, certainly than Chris Allen was. I don't know if Anderson busts that much anymore, like the times he might've last year, but that would be the issue. But Anderson is in the Thibodeau mode in terms of being able to wreck your game.
Yeah. I'm interested really to see, I'd love to see Alabama's offense tested a little bit more physically. Like I would love to see them, you know, it's been pretty easy for Bryce Young right now. He hasn't had to do much from a standpoint of anything that there's been little opposition so far through the first couple games. Alabama's been able to physically overtake Mercer, physically overtake Miami. When you can't physically do that, you know, can he be is he the guy that can? And I think he is. I think he can buy time. He's got a lightning quick release. He's got a knack. You can tell, bro, he's got a knack for making plays. Like he's got that it factor that you could see. But also I want to see him get hit because he ain't big. Like I want to put some stings on him. By the way, this might sound dirty, whatever you call, whatever the heck you want to call it. I'm a defensive guy. I don't give a crap what you call it regardless. I'm going to hit him and I'm going to land on top of him with all of my body weight and make sure he feels every ounce of it. And I'm going to make it physically hard on him. And that's, I would love to see some people get after him maybe a little bit more, maybe test that offensive line. But how about the other side of the ball though? How about Anthony Richardson? Like do we have controversy in Gainesville? I mean, he looked pretty daggum solid.
I thought the way Mullen described it was pretty interesting. Like he does some remarkable things, but also sometimes because he's young, he doesn't do the right thing all the time. So I think we're in for a two quarterback system for a while, but
Dan likes that anyways.
Yeah.
Dan loves that. He does. One of the few that loves that.
How about this for his, I mean, Richardson's played quite a bit first couple of games, but he's tied for the, you know, it's early. I know, but he's tied for the national lead. He's got two runs of 70 yards or longer. One of them's 80 and he's got a 70 yard pass play too. And he's huge. He's fast. He's, you know, I mean,
I can't decide if he's fast or not. Like I'm watching him run and he seems like one of those guys on tape that just, he's kind of just effortlessly running. Like when Emory Jones runs, I feel like Emory Jones is flying. He to me looks like hyper athletic 4.4 type of guy. Richardson's, I mean, he's like what, 236? Like he's a bigger guy, 6'4", 235 pounds. And he doesn't look like he's running fast, but ain't nobody catching him. I mean, level of competition. Let's, you know, pump the brakes a little bit too, but I think we'll find out a little bit more about, you know, Florida. I think we'll learn about both these teams, by the way. We're going to figure out right away who's better, who's improved. How about the defensive side of the ball for Florida, man? Like they got punked last year. They stunk. That was not Florida's defense that I'm used to seeing from an athletic standpoint. Are they better in the trenches? Are they more disruptive? Because they were not disruptive at all a year ago.
I think Cincinnati's got two tests over the next 3 weeks, both on the road, both in the state of Indiana, going to Bloomington.
Both seem a lot easier than they did preseason, bro.
They do. But I will accept those as signals that Cincinnati belongs, because especially if they go in and control the game, because that's the first mark of an excellent team is you take care of business against teams you ought to beat. And I think the spread's only a field goal or so against Indiana on Saturday.
3.5, baby.
Yeah. So I expect Cincinnati to do that. I mean, I know they didn't come out exactly inspired against Murray State, but you know what happens when you play a poor first half? If you're a good team, you come out and you steamroll them in the second. And that's what they did.
So you expect them to do what? What do you expect?
I expect Cincinnati to win and cover the spread.
So you expect them to roll?
I don't think they're going to beat them by 3 touchdowns or anything like that, but I would not be surprised if they beat them by 10.
Yeah, I think Desmond Ridder week one was by far and away the best I've ever seen him throw the football. And that's kind of because he's always been a little bit of a streaky passer. He's a great athlete, and what they do with the system, they do a beautiful job using his athleticism. I don't have a lot of positives to say about Indiana after the week one. I mean, Penix Jr. maybe gets healthier and more confident in his knee, and that will help. But when I think about the quick passing game against Cincinnati's defense, that's not where you're going to get them. I feel like Notre Dame might have a better chance if they can get them in a phone booth and hit them in the face and maybe pound the football. So I think this is not going to end well for Indiana. And I'm with you. I like what Cincinnati is. I like that matchup for them. And then 2 weeks against Notre Dame, bro, let's bring it on.
You know, I love how the picture of a season comes into focus as you get. I mean, it's fun to make predictions. It's fun to look at a game or two or watch a practice or talk to coaches or whatever and formulate opinions. But you gather more and more information and the picture becomes more clear. For instance, on the subject of Penix Jr. and not looking good opening week. Well, let's see what's happened here. Veteran quarterback Michael Penix Jr. looked terrible opening week. Veteran quarterback Brock Purdy looked really bad the next week. There's a common denominator there. It's the fellas who have the Hawkeyes on the side of their helmet. Firsthand calling that game, that's only thing that gives me a little pause about maybe Indiana being a little bit better is that I think Iowa's defense is legit. I think they're really good, David. They don't have the explosive pass rushers that they had last year, but their secondary linebackers are good, and their defensive line is disruptive enough, I think. Did you agree watching or not?
Yeah, they're very annoying, by the way, because they don't – like all the new school offense and all the stuff that comes at you. And listen, against Ohio State, we'd be able to tell more because you can be very conservative and you can be very zone heavy against those teams, against a lot of teams. But once you start dumping it underneath to some of the freak shows that Ohio State has, it makes you look a lot more human and a lot slower and a lot less athletic. So, I'll hold judgment until they play a really athletic team. But I think that just they're so annoying because they play their assignments. They have vision on the quarterback. They're not going to give you much, man. They're not going to make those mistakes that cost you 7 points. They're going to make you execute time and time and time and time again. And guess what happens when you have to do that offensively? A holding call. Now it's first and 20.
I jumped off an interception.
I trust in their defense 100%. I think they can keep them in games, but you got to have offense. And I don't. Is Goodson their only offense? I don't know if their offense is going to be good. Like, think about going against Ohio State. Sure. Like, I can limit you and I can make you drive the length of the field, maybe kick some field goals, maybe stop you a couple times. But can I answer or am I going to wear those dudes out? Are they going to play so many plays and then they're going to be, way less effective? So I think the Hawkeyes defense is really, really good offensively. We'll see.
Yeah, I agree because I think right now, if memory serves, I think their offense has scored 4 touchdowns and their defense has scored 3. They had 2 pick sixes against Indiana. Then they had
fumble recovery,
the scoop and score against Iowa State. But I think their defense is really good. I think they've got some potential on offense, but they haven't been consistent in the passing game yet. And really, they haven't been great in the running game, but they had the long run against Indiana. Didn't really, it's been, other than the long run against Indiana, it hasn't been great yet. But, they still have time, and they'll still have some challenges within the Big Ten. Let's hit on this game, too, simply because I think there are a lot of different storylines around Oklahoma and Nebraska. 50 years after one of the games of the century, one of the greatest games in the history of the sport, one of the most iconic games. They're celebrating that. I think Johnny Rogers is going to be back in town for the game. The great Nebraska Heisman Trophy winner didn't win the Heisman Trophy that year, by the way, won it the following year. They did win the national championship after winning the game of the century. And Oklahoma comes in. They're going to be a heavy favorite. There's so much turmoil around Nebraska. One thing I think that's important is that Nebraska is not going to make a knee-jerk reaction. Like, and not that SC was knee-jerk, but they're not going to make a mid-season decision as USC did. They're not even going to make the decision the same way. The administration at Nebraska understands who they are, and what they're looking for is fight. They think they're seeing fight right now. Scott Frost believes he's seeing fight. They're fighting hard, if not always fighting well. Fighting hard is going to be and playing without, you know, special teams meltdowns, inexplicable turnovers. Playing like that is the first step. You think back in Nebraska history, that 71 team was more talented than everybody, and probably the two Tommy Frazier teams were more talented than everybody, or at least equal to everybody. The other great Nebraska teams in the middle, maybe 83 too, even though they lost, but those other really great Nebraska teams sort of developed and fought you. You know, they weren't always the ones that overwhelmed you with talent, with those notable exceptions. I want to be clear about that. I mean, those teams were uber talented. So what they're looking for Saturday is to not play sloppy and to fight and to believe that they can win and try to give themselves the best chance. I think they're too outmanned to win the game, but the score may get out of hand. People may get up in arms, but that's not going to lead to a change. And I think that's appropriate. What do you think?
I think the strange part about it is, you know, we just talked about Ferentz. We just talked about Campbell. You know, teams that are, again, like Nebraska, in my opinion, they're always going to be behind the eight ball athletically. They're not going to be, you know, blue chip recruits anymore all over the field. So you said they got to be tough. You said they can't beat themselves. Nebraska makes a living on that. That's what drives me nuts, man. I don't understand catching punts in your end zone, for God's sakes. I don't understand. Every time something good happens, it's a penalty. You know, like you fumble and they scoop and score right before the half. In Illinois, you give up like 30 points in like 32 seconds. Obviously, sarcasm insert. But I would like to see that too. I'd like to see Scott Frost come to some point, at some point, have an identity on offense about something they can hang their hat on. Like, you know, what do we do really, really well? You know, why can't Adrian Martinez at some point be consistent? Like, why can't we ask him to do something? I saw flashes, you know, a couple weeks ago where he had an 80 yard run, for God's sakes. Or it might've been this past week where he breaks 65 tackles and looks like the Herschel Walker, for goodness sakes. And then you see times where he's not very good. So I think what you're speaking to me is consistency. Like, show up every week, be the same team. I can hang my hat on what? Can I hang my hat on black shirts? Can I hang my hat on running the football? Like, what can I hang my hat on? Nebraska football used to hang their hat on toughness and black shirts and running the daggum football down your throat with an athletic quarterback. Eat it. Take it. What are you going to do about it? And I watch this team and I see them beat themselves. I don't see a lot of things that I love from their identity that I can sit there and go, hey, let me rally behind you. I don't find those.
You know, it's I think I know you're exactly right. I had a conversation with my old college football final partner, Trev Alberts. He, Mark May, and I, you know, spent some time in the studio the other day. Trev, the athletic director at Nebraska, we were talking about some other stuff outside of it, but he probably put it as eloquently as you possibly can. He said, "Nobody's coming to save the Cornhuskers, Reese. We're going to have to do that ourselves." So the first step to saving yourself is not beating yourself. And I think Nebraska doesn't need moral victories with the rich history and legacy of that program. So I'm not suggesting it's okay for them to lose ever. That's not what I mean. But if they could go to Norman and play the way you're saying, don't field a punt on the one and let it carry you into the end zone and then try to pass it out. Don't get the foolish penalty. In the words of Bill Curry, make sure that football is riveted to your rib cage. You know, don't spit it out. Don't throw it to the other guy. Play that way and see how close you are. You'll get a gauge if you can do that. That's the first step. Now, can they do that? They haven't yet. We'll see Saturday, but I'm excited about that game just because of the pageantry surrounding it. We've talked about it before. It's the first football season I remember. I remember watching that game as a kid. I don't remember the details because I was 5 years old, but I remember that game being on television. And, you know, anytime black
and white,
no, it was color, Black Flash 41 reverse, you know, with Eric Kraut scoring the big thing. And then Sooner Magic, that phrase, Sooner Magic, was largely born out of Nebraska having Barry Switzer's teams beaten time and time and time again. And Oklahoma would find a way. They'd pull it out of the fire every time. And, you know, that's sort of part of the origin of Sooner Magic. So I'm excited about the game. I hope Nebraska lives up to its end of the bargain. You're not excited about the game.
I love that I get a glimpse back to the 50s when you were a child. I thoroughly enjoy that. But I don't see the excitement. I'll learn from Oklahoma. Can they had a shutout last week on defense. Is their defense going to be as good as we think they can possibly be? But
Western Carolina. They look 35 to Tulane, but they do have Pro Football Focus, the two guys leading the nation in pressures. Now, I'm sure they built up some of that against Western Carolina, but two guys from OU. Yeah. So, you know, Benito being one of the,
I want to see that dominance against Nebraska.
Well, you probably will. All right. I'm going to give you one more that I'm interested in, and then we'll let Travis off the hook here and end the podcast. Michigan State and Miami. Miami hasn't looked great. First order of business for Miami. Don't let Michigan State go 75 yards for a touchdown in the first snap of the game, which they have done in each of their first two games.
Kenneth Walker, and this is kind of crazy to say, when I watch Michigan State, I see some juice. Like, I see some guys that I know it's basically transfer portal, Michigan State transfer portal is what it basically has become, but good for Mel Tucker. Like, I see guys that can catch the ball and go 75. I see a running back that after contact leads the nation in rushing. Like, he's breaking tackles. He looks really, really good. I see a quarterback. He's not – usually Michigan State has a pocket passer. They can make plays, can't do anything else. Or they got a guy back there, and you're like, all right, he can run a little bit. I think he can do a little bit of both. So I like what I've seen so far from Michigan State. I think they're pretty good. I think I got enough evidence to say that I think they're good. They're going in the right direction, and you should be excited if you're a Michigan State fan.
You know, I agree with you. I mean, I've been really impressed and watching them a little bit too. I went back to see if Walker had faced Miami before in his Wake Forest days, and as it turns out, he hasn't, so you don't have anything to go on there. But I think that's going to be fun too. And who knows? Maybe they'll catch a cat falling out of the rafters in a flag or something.
That was amazing, by the way. That was unbelievable. But hey, what do we know about Miami? Like, are you ready to punt?
No, because I'm a believer in the Bama aftermath. Sometimes when you get steamrolled by the tide, it takes you a couple of weeks to recover. So, and Appalachian State's a pretty good team. So I'm going to give them a little latitude and a little more time and reserve some judgment on that, because I think they beat up D'Eric a little bit, probably wounded an ego or two. And so let's see what we get Saturday. And I think you'll have
that might be my super dog, by the way.
Really? What's the number on that?
You have 6.5 for Miami.
6.5. By the way, do you know how hard I was rooting to whip Jones in the back door to cover? I didn't get the outright win. How about that? Not only did you get the back door, they got the ball back and threw to the end zone for the win. So, you know, at least I got on the board.
That's what's great about the Superdogs. You're watching teams that you necessarily wouldn't watch, cheering a different color and probably more colorful a lot of times too with rooting for your super dog.
Dude, I was sitting, and you're going to be mad about one part of this. I was sitting in a Hampton Inn in Des Moines, Iowa with Wingstop delivered by DoorDash, watching Memphis and Arkansas State on my phone while I had like another one on the TV screen and one on the iPad after the game. And the others were good, but I'm sitting there, I'm glued to trying to get James Blackman, the former Seminole, to lead us to victory there. But anyway,
that's amazing. What did you get from Wingstop?
I can't tell you. You'll fuss at me too much. It was late. I was tired.
I'll judge you.
Yeah, you'll judge me.
Oh, but
I can tell you this.
It was late. I was tired. Don't worry about discipline. I don't need this. It's only when I'm awake.
The barbecue sauce was spectacular. There, by the way, I'd never eaten there before. So, anyway. Okay. Salad since then, though, Pollock. Salad and lean meat since then, so that's okay.
That a boy. When you get off the train, you got to get back on the tracks. It's all good. You get off the tracks, you steer back in, and you tighten it up a little bit, and then we go.
That's right, and then we go. So that means when we go to Penn State this week, we'll veer off the tracks down to the creamery for a minute, right? The sticky bun, a little ice cream.
I hope not, but if you choose to go that route, you dang sure better salad it up again the next week. Oh, boy.
All right, my man, a reminder, the College Football Pod is 5 days a week, so make sure to rate and review and follow. You don't want to miss anything, especially when Pollock and I start talking youth football there and the dynamics of making sure that your corner replaces. Also, the Peabody and Emmy Award-winning 30 for 30 film series presents Once Upon a Time in Queens. That's a four-part documentary event about the city, the swagger, and the wild ride of the 1986 Mets. Documentary explores the epic tale of one of baseball's most dominant and iconoclastic teams and the legendary World Series comeback. You can hear from former Mets players and fans, including Daryl Strawberry, Keith Hernandez, Bill Burr, Cyndi Lauper, and more. Maybe Keith Hernandez will address the two-spitter theory. That is for you Seinfeld fans. Watch parts 1 and 2 of Once Upon a Time in Queens, Tuesday, September 14th, 8 o'clock Eastern on ESPN, followed by parts 3 and 4 Wednesday, September 15th, and also at 8 p.m. Eastern time and available to stream on ESPN Plus and the ESPN app immediately after its premiere. David, I will see you in State College.
All right, dude.